Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming this evening. So I've been tinkering a little bit on trying to reestablish that the fourth Wednesday evening we could have two periods of Zazen, a short service, and an informal talk. And so that could be me, or it could be you. It could be anybody. And I know we had Edie give a nice example the other night, a talk about her own life and practice. That's one option. A few times Chris has shared with us her study of Shantideva. Somehow I always miss them, but I know she does. No offense. Yeah. And so I might tap you on the shoulder, or you could think whether you'd like to share something you're studying. And you don't have to talk the whole time. You could bring a reading. Just share some little something you've been thinking about in your practice and in your life, or something you just ran into that you really thought would be great for the Sangha to hear. And then conversely, on the second Wednesday of the night, well, I think we'll have one little bit longer period of Zazen and Kinhin and no service, and I'll give a formal talk with bells and whistles and discussion groups and all kinds of stuff. You know, more of a seminar kind of thing. Does that sound okay? So, first of all, various people worked here over the weekend, so I want to thank them. Some people worked on putting up wood. Some people came and worked on membership. Some people came and worked on sewing. And so it was kind of great because nobody really knew who was coming when or why or what. It just kind of people came and went sort of randomly, and all these wonderful things happened. So thank you if you were involved in that. Or maybe you're just having a nice weekend. Also a good idea. One of the things I've always appreciated about Zen is we really try to remember that, you know, everyone's contributions are really, you know, the same, you know, non-different. And so the carpenter crew did a very impressive-looking thing, and we can all run around thanking them. But meanwhile, many other people are doing very important things that we don't even know about, you know. So it's a nice thing to remember. One aspect of that I've always appreciated is that in the tradition they say one shouldn't ever thank or criticize the cook. Just leave him alone, you know. Because food is so loaded, you know, especially you're doing meditation retreat. Food's kind of a loaded thing. It's like your big sense pleasure of the day, and so it'd be easy to get either very upset or very excited about the cooking, you know. So that's a nice sort of equanimity kind of practice, you know, to just give the cook some space to do her practice, you know, like you are doing yours. Anyway, tonight I wanted to share with you some writing by my teacher, Norman Fisher, about his teacher, Mel Weitzman. And at the end, add a few just brief remarks of my own about teachers and students and kind of what are we doing here? What are we trying to pass on? What are we teaching about? What is it, the sort of essence of what we're trying to do? So Norman's teacher is Sojin Mel Weitzman, who recently turned 80. And the funny thing about that is, when Norman first was studying with Mel, Mel was about the age I am now. And when I started studying with Norman, Norman was about the age I am now. So I don't know. I'm one of the younger people here, so I won't talk about how old I am, but it's interesting, you know, to think, you know, we always think, well, I'm not old enough or wise enough to do these things. And then we learn about the people that came before us, and like, well, they were doing this at my exact age, you know. Somehow they found a way. Here's what Norman said about Mel. Mel has been an inspiration, a guide, and a friend to me since I was a young man. I am one of the old Dwight Way crowd, which is like their first Zendo. They had like an attic in a house. Like some people here were part of the Fairhaven Library crowd. It's the same idea. Recently, I drove by that old place. It's still there, but the yucca and the monkey puzzle trees in the front yard that were of a modest size in the early 1970s are quite large now, dwarfing the house. I was struck at how different the place looked. I attributed the difference to the fact that the practice, Mel's practice and spirit, vacated the space so long ago. Then the place had a simplicity and a dignity it doesn't have now, a quiet but insistent presence. Having felt these things then in the actual physical space, and feeling them now makes me understand better the virtue of Mel's teaching. These are the words I would use to describe it. Simplicity, dignity, and a quiet but insistent presence. It seems to me that the main characteristic of Suzuki Roshi's teaching and of Soto Zen is faith in the practice, and a steadiness and endurance to keep going with the practice no matter what. As Dogen taught so profoundly, the practice is the enlightenment. There is no enlightenment outside of practice. In the early days, and I know it is the same now, it was clear, without anyone ever needing to say so, that this was the value most encouraged by Mel. There was sitting every morning at 5 a.m., and Mel was there every day, always on time. Whether there was one person or two or three joining him, and there were seldom more than three or four, he was always there, sitting in his place at the head of the stairs, so that when you walked up those steep stairs to the attic, you would see him first, just there, always there, motionless and quiet. Dwight Way was a pretty busy street, and there was sometimes traffic by the end of the morning session. But traffic or no traffic, whatever was going on, there was just steady, silent sitting. Every day, week after week, month after month, and by now, decade after decade, though the location has changed and the years have sped by, but I am guessing that in this the practice remains the same, and the spirit remains the same. Just do the practice. Have faith in the practice. Come what may. Be steady and endure. Practice what is. And during the all-day sits, held once a month, as I recall, there was frequently lots of noise in the neighborhood, conversations, sometimes loud music. We would either sit through it, taking it as a benefit. Practice is all-inclusive. It is not about having to be quiet. Or if it was too much, Mel would go out and talk to whomever it was, and somehow it would always be more quiet afterward. That quiet after the noise was an even quieter quiet. You know what he means there? Yeah. Things can be really quiet, but we don't appreciate it, you know. Not saying much, not explaining much, this was how it was in those days. There were no sesshin, no dokusan, which is a private meeting, nothing special or spectacular, no large impressive Buddhas on the altar. Mel gave, I think, a talk at the all-day sittings, or maybe there was a weekly Dharma talk, but those events were always themselves very quiet, just part of the schedule, not a big deal. I always found them moving and encouraging, but they were not charismatic or complicated or exciting. Mel would speak very simply about our practice, often bringing up sayings of old Zen teachers or Dogen, and there was a simplicity to the way he expressed things. Really, I can't remember now much of what Mel said, but the general impression I had was of steadiness and wisdom and beauty. Conviction, but lightly held. Mel was a handsome fellow in those days, not that he still isn't at 80, and the main message in those talks, at least the message I received, was just that, the dignity and handsomeness of the teachings. There was no insistence or pushing of any kind, and in a quiet voice, Mel would just tell us something about the teachings. He was very careful always in instructing us about how to walk, how to stand, how to eat, how to serve meals and ring bells, how to carry the stick and the zendo, and so on. Physical carriage and form were important, and he would tell us about them, but not over and over again, maybe just once. The sense of quiet and restraint, even about things that were clearly important, was very strong. A phrase Mel would often use, maybe he still does, was the other side, by which he meant something like, things are done or meant this way, this is how we understand it, but there is always the other side. You should do things slowly, but the other side is you should do them quickly. Such and such is the case, but on the other side is that it is not the case. I'm pretty sure Mel got this from Suzuki Roshi, though as I recall, Mel didn't talk about Suzuki Roshi nearly as much then as he does now, and it seems very similar to me to Suzuki Roshi's Not Always So. Maybe Suzuki Roshi also said the other side. I wouldn't be surprised. I think that much of what Mel said in those days and the ways in which he said it was directly inspired by Suzuki Roshi, whose presence, I now imagine, looking back from a perspective of nearly 40 years, was very much with Mel all the time. However, he didn't consciously reference Suzuki Roshi very much. The sense that the practice, unlike anything we had previously thought of as religion, was more or less entirely a matter of physical presence was very strong in those early days. As I've said, though the place was extremely simple, and not particularly Asian or Japanese in style or decor, you could feel this. There was a spareness in everything, an austerity, and also a beauty. You'd walk into the house and everything already seemed quiet. You didn't have to go upstairs to the Zendo. Just approaching the front door, you always felt the quiet. It was just a plain and ordinary, modest Berkeley Victorian house, but it was always clean, things were always in their places. There were simple pictures on the walls, small ones, except for one really large blue abstract painting by Mel from his San Francisco beatnik artist days, very Clifford Still influenced. There was a bulletin board by the front door with only a few necessary announcements on it, like the schedule. The kitchen where we had coffee after morning zazen was neat and ready, never any dishes left over from yesterday. There was a sense that everything was cared for. Everything was considered and tended to. There was no sense that things were displayed for effect. They were just there. They were useful. They were simple. They were there. No effort whatever was made to impress anyone, or even to express that this was a Zen or a Buddhist place. Probably it was clear it was. I'm sure there were pieces of calligraphy or Zen art on the walls, but I can't remember now. I think there was a library with Buddhist books. But the feeling was that no effort was being made to emphasize this point. It was as if everything expressed a practice. That is, things were there to be used and to be cared for, not to make a point. You could really feel this. Out in the backyard, where Mel spent a considerable amount of time, there was an extensive garden, whose main feature was an old plum tree that had spread out over the years so that its branches seemed to reach everywhere. When it was in flower, it dominated the yard. You would have to walk bent over to avoid the profusion of white blossoms that seemed to be everywhere. Blossoms and bees that went with them. Otherwise, there were vegetables, a serious number of them. Mel was an organic gardener, something of an early expert in the field. And he worked very hard growing vegetables for the Sangha. So the backyard was quite extensive and full. It seemed a world in itself. And although the neighbor's house and yard weren't far away, they seemed far away. And there were always projects afoot in the yard that we engaged in during work periods at our monthly day-long sittings. Work period and work practice were always central to the Zendo life, and Mel usually led the work and usually knew exactly what he wanted done. My training there taught me that work and Zen were synonymous. Mel modeled a way of working that was exemplary. Steady effort, over time, without too much exertion, always accomplished with tremendous focus and in silence. In the early 1970s, when my life more or less fell apart, and I was in a state of confusion and near dysfunction, Mel and Liz took me into their lives, into the healing space of the Zendo environs. Mel didn't say much to me, didn't offer advice, or even ask me to talk much about what my problems were. But he opened the house to me, gave me a room to sleep in, and every day there was work, sitting, and simple meals. Little by little, I began to come back to myself. Often we had lunch out in the garden, under the plum tree. We drank cups of delicious green tea, ate good dark bread and cheese, and said almost nothing. In those days, there was a family feeling in the Zendo community. There weren't many of us, but we were all dedicated and completely steady in our practice, which for all of us was the center of our lives. As our teacher and guide, and also as a person nearly 20 years older than most of us, Mel was somewhat aloof. Distinctly in a different position, yet also warm and close. Without intervening much, he encouraged and supported us all in our various efforts to figure out who we were and what we were supposed to be doing. I'm not sure we realized this then, but looking at it now, it seems pretty clear. My dear old friend Alan Liu was active in the group then and became what was called the director. He and Mel were very close. When Su Moon's Open Books published our first books of poetry, so Norman and Alan's first books of poetry, Mel encouraged us to give what was our first reading ever, downstairs in the basement of the Zendo. A lot of people came, and for courage we both, well, I speak for myself, got pretty drunk, and gave what we thought were brilliant readings. But were probably quite stupid and self-indulgent performances. The point is that Mel allowed this. He encouraged us and didn't complain about how it turned out. When Alan died suddenly early this year, Mel and Liz had a gathering at their house for people from those days to recall him and those times long ago. The beginning of things are always special. Even though as things go on, they actually do become better, more developed, fairer and more competent, more effective, larger, and so on. But the beginnings always have a special character, a simplicity, a pungency. I didn't know Suzuki Roshi. I was actually around when he was alive and functioning before his illness. But I was too blind and ignorant to realize that I had a chance to meet a great teacher, and I ought to take it. Instead, I was wrapped up in my own thoughts and needs. I didn't feel I had any use for a teacher. Mel appealed to me because he didn't even call himself a teacher or come across as one. He was just a priest, leading the practice, just there. Not somebody one would somehow get credit for having known. And people didn't make any fuss over him. Because Mel didn't mention Suzuki Roshi very much, I barely even knew he existed. I remember a notice of his funeral appearing one day on the little bulletin board by the front door. A modest notice, as I recall. It didn't seem like anything I'd want to go to. Didn't know the guy. What's the point of attending a funeral anyway? Clearly, though, the people who knew Suzuki Roshi and who were able to practice with him were deeply moved by him. Probably each one of them carried away with them their own private Suzuki Roshi, their own view, from the standpoint of their own karma and of who he was, what his life expressed. They say that when a good teacher gives a Dharma talk, each listener comes away with a different talk, a talk given just for them. And I'm sure this was true of Suzuki Roshi's whole sense of life and practice. Each one had their own Suzuki Roshi, each one of his students. It seems to me that Mel Suzuki Roshi embodied the qualities I've been speaking of. The quiet, the simplicity, the modesty, the supportiveness without saying or doing much, the simple beauty, devotion to work and steady daily practice. Though I am a generation away, I have heard the Suzuki Roshi stories, met and studied with most of Suzuki Roshi's disciples, read the talks, heard the tapes, bowed monthly and yearly at memorial services, so I feel I also know him. And he does seem to me very like Mel. A good student takes in a great teacher and makes him completely his own. I think Mel has really done this with his teacher. But probably I haven't done this with mine as well. Maybe it's because I'm not a devoted enough student, or maybe I still haven't gotten over my excessive interest in my own thoughts and needs. Or maybe Mel is not a great enough teacher. Probably, though, it is none of these. Probably it's because times have changed, and we all build on what has gone before. So what was possible at the beginning? The kind of inspiring devotion to a teacher, the full incorporation of him or her into one's own life, is not so possible after a while, I don't know. But I do know that I have not digested Mel's teaching in the same way that he digested that of his teacher. I remain, for better or worse, myself, with my own inclinations and interests. My style of practice is probably not much like Mel's or like Suzuki Roshi's, and comes out of my own necessities more than anything else. I left Berkeley because I wanted to do monastic practice at Tassajara, which is the monastery. Just before I entered the monastery, I married, and we had children right away, which complicated things. We had twins, too, and caused us to remain residents at San Francisco Zen Center for 25 years or so longer than we planned. I was ordained as a Zen priest by then Abbot Dick Baker in 1980 with my wife Kathy, with our 3-year-old twin sons looking on in strange, gleeful amusement. After I finished a term as Abbot of Zen Center in year 2000, I began the Everyday Zen Foundation, a network of Zen communities and associated projects which now involves a lot of talented and interesting people who practice Zen together with me all over the place in various ways. Some not even quite identifiable as Zen, though many of the groups are local Soto Zen groups, similar to the old Berkeley Zen Center. So, unlike Mel, I travel constantly, and I have no place that I can take care of. My way of practice emphasizes committed disciplined daily sitting, with the sitting usually done alone at home. None of our places support daily sitting, along with time for sesshin or weekend retreats. Still in the grip of my old writing habit, I continue to write books of poetry and prose books, and my practice emphasizes, in a way that I don't think Mel's or Suzuki Roshi's does, written expression and study and cultural involvement. I've also found that expression and communication and close personal relationships with students, without much reserve, is at the heart of my practice. This does come naturally to me, This seems to come naturally to me. I don't know if I could avoid it, even if I wanted to. I'm not that much on work, but not that I don't do it or don't believe in it. I do work a bit around the house, but left to my own devices, I would read, write, or exercise. I try to take care of the physical world, but I guess I don't do it so well. But I hope, and I believe, that I have deeply internalized the faithfulness to simple practice, to no-frills constancy and endurance over time, that I learned at Mel's place long ago, and that I believe is the heart of Suzuki Roshi's way as well, just to practice, and to be willing to share practice in a simple way with others. No big secret teachings, no profound enlightenment, just simple, stupid Soto Zen. I think this is the case, Mel's first Dharma heir. We completed the Shiho Dharma transmission ceremonies October 25th, a full moon night in 1988 at Tassajara. A wonderful experience for both of us, although we probably stumbled through it without knowing exactly how to do it. Since then, I have transmitted Dharma to 11 priests, some of whom were Mel's disciples in addition to being students of mine, and I did the ceremonies with his blessing as a way of helping him out. Some were priests ordained by others who needed help with the last stages of their training, and some were people I ordained and trained. The last time I did the ceremonies, in March of 2009, I had Mel's picture, the one I keep in the study, on the transmission altar. In this picture, Mel is in his civvies, wearing a rakusu, in close-up, body turned to one side, smiling wonderfully, looking as if he is about to come forward from his chair towards the viewer to say hello or give a hug. A very friendly, informal picture. It's nice to have it with us, guiding the process along. What, after all, is the Zen teacher? And what role is he or she supposed to have in the life of a committed student? As I've said, I don't know whether this is a reflection of Mel's character or mine, but Mel has not been a guide or an advisor to me much in the usual sense. Even when we practiced together every day, we didn't talk much. And for many years, when I was at San Francisco Zen Center, we didn't see each other very regularly. So I've not sought out his advice generally, though of course sometimes I have, when I needed advice. And it seems to me my relationship to him is deeper and more mysterious than this. In a way, I don't need his advice anyway, because I know what he thinks, know what he would say. I have internalized his view in this way. Though of course I recognize he might not agree with me, that the Mel and me, the real Mel, and me may not agree with the other Mel who thinks he's Mel and who others call Mel. But this doesn't mean I don't need that exterior Mel. In fact, without saying anything or doing anything in relationship to me directly, he helps me a lot just by being in the world, continuing to do what he has always done. His mysterious activity in the physical world across the bay over there in Berkeley is a continuous support to me. And if it should happen that he dies before I do, I'll miss him a lot, even though I don't see him that often. The influence of a Zen teacher on a committed student is very powerful. It is ordinary and extraordinary at the same time. As I understand it, the teacher doesn't really know what he's doing. That is, he doesn't scope out the student, decide what is needed, and then proceed sneakily and subtly to make sure the student gets it. Instead, the teacher just continues the practice with a benevolent wish for the student. Between them, something deeply important happens. Something transformative occurs. Though neither one seems to be in charge of it, it just happens, somehow, between them, because they're willing for it to happen, because they're willing to go on with the practice come what may, because they have faith and trust and courage. In any case, this is what I've come to understand from my Dogen studies and from my life. This is what I have faith in after nearly 40 years of continuous practice with Mel. Isn't that a beautiful testimony? So I think it's lovely to hear these stories, and I think not so much that we would romanticize these people in those times and wish we had been there and, you know, not done all the things that we have done in our lives, you know, if only we'd been 22 and doing Zazen all the time, but to appreciate the effort of the teachers and students before us. To be inspired with some realistic and heartfelt feeling for what they have done. And of course, they weren't thinking of us, didn't know that we exist. They were just doing the practice. Because one can think about Zen and think about one's life and think about sunsets and think about all kinds of things. But actually, what's really transformational and really real for us is a lived experience that's only come upon through steady effort, you know, through work. And we only really learn about through contact and interaction with other people who've gone before us. So I really appreciate Norman's attitude towards his teacher. And Norman doesn't feel like he's a failure exactly, that he doesn't practice in that style, having a small temple somewhere, doing zazen at 5 a.m. every day. But that he's learned from that style and moved to his own style, and we're all allowing Zen practice to develop in the way that it needs to. But I think always with this lived and felt appreciation for what's really fundamental in our lives. And I think it's so easy, and I'm talking to myself here mostly, it's so easy for us to think about programs and clever ways we could explain the teachings and new books we should read, and it's so hard to keep up, and there's all these magazines. There's like 3 major Buddhist magazines, you know, it's like expensive to even keep up with all this, you know. And now we're creating a library and trying to expand it. You know, one might think, oh my gosh, you know, what a burden. And so maybe we need these stories about Mel Weitzman, who I know a little bit too, to remind us of the limitless nature, you know, of just simple devotion to sitting, to being quiet, to appreciating and working with the physical world just to take care of it. And it reminds us that the Zen tradition is very much, as I was saying, it's a lived understanding. You can learn some useful things from books about Zen practice, but it's really a lived understanding that is passed. Sometimes they say that Zen is passed from warm hand to warm hand. That warm hand to warm hand, that's the only way it can be transmitted. And so what can we expect from our teachers, one might ask? And I think because of the kind of brains we have, we expect a lot. We expect our teachers to be very smart, to figure out the right kind of format and structure, and to say all the right things that we need to hear. We expect our teachers to schedule the events properly and not make any mistakes. And we expect our teachers to sort of see in our heads and figure out what we need. And so part of how we benefit in the student-teacher relationship is by being a bit disappointed, by finding out that that is not how it goes. But hopefully, if we're grounded through our practice, we can also feel and appreciate what's really real in that relationship, which is much more subtle than mysterious and important than the teacher getting anything right. So I think what we can expect from our teachers is devotion to practice and steadiness. And if they get confused and run around and try to figure things out, we'd be patient with them and wait for them to come back to ground, just like they will do for us. And another note about that story, which is kind of the other side, is what about the woman? What about their wives? I don't know if my wife would be so happy if I invited a messed up 20-year-old Zen student to move into her house, you know? So there are some things that are changing probably for the better. That Zen in those days was absolutely a male-dominated, you know, thing, and that devotion to Zazen had a very macho and exclusive flavor to it also, amidst the incredible beauty of it. But maybe that's just what had to happen. But it occurred to me, I've never even met Mel's wife, you know. I didn't know her name was Liz until I read this, you know. And I've spent a fair amount of time over there, too. So what is handed down to us is not perfect, but there's something to it that we can only appreciate through steady practice over time And that's why we really need teachers, because we can see it in their bodies and hear it in their voice, regardless of what they're doing or saying. And Jeff McKenna is not here tonight, but he has said a very beautiful thing a few times that he learned, I think, from the Native communities that he is a part of. He said, what we're really doing here is just keeping the seat warm for the people. We're appreciating the people who came before. We're keeping the seat warm for the people who come after. So that's been inspiring for me to think about that when I get sort of busy and worried about it. We're just keeping the seat warm. So let us see if we can continue that practice. I didn't chew up all the time for once. Anyone have any comments, things to add? Or teacher stories?